Good evening, everybody. This is just a little check-in before dinner. I'm making burroks tonight, and burroks are a anyway, my soul food of my family. My mother's side, they were Germans in ethnically German in Russia and actually probably Ukraine. And so they would make they immigrated to Kansas in the early 20th century, and they would make these things called burroks, which I guess are sort of like pierogies, but they're it's sort of a dough with it's like a sandwich. It's just like an enclosed, but like with ground beef and cabbage and onions, and then you wrap this sort of eggy dough around it. And anyway, I make it every once in a while, but today I was delinquent in getting the dough started early enough, so I've got about an hour to kill until the dough rises and I can put my burroks together for dinner. And you serve them, you bake them till they're all puffy and brown, and then you cut them in half and you slather some good mustard on them, and they're really good. But anyway, so I've got the burroks dough waiting over there, and I wanted to say sort of thanks to start off with, because I'm going to share a poem with you tonight that someone who is far more talented in writing than I am created. And you may have already read it on the blog. I posted it earlier this morning, but it was left as a comment yesterday on the Andrew Peck blog post. And just very clever, very, very, very clever. And I just thought it merited a wider audience. And then it's funny how things sort of roll together. Like you'll have one thing and then the next thing and the next. So I've been spending the last 3 days like really someone was able to surface links to all of the early financial documents filed with the government for Children's Health Defense. And actually, it was only started to be Children's Health Defense in 2018. Before that was called the Mercury Project. And so I've been going through, and it's incorporated in California, and they keep really good records. So I going like all the way back to 2007-8 when it started, and then when it like 2014 it really took off with the money, and then of course so with lockdown just like crazy amounts of money. And the most recent financial document that I saw is for 2021, and the money coming in to Children's Health Defense in 2021 was $16 million. Right? So it went from this little organization with like one or a handful of people making this movie about mercury in these like budgets of like $5,000, $20,000, and then it just ratcheted right on up, and now we're sitting at I don't know what it was in 2022, but in 2021, according to their tax filings, it was $16 million. And yeah, the Camelotters don't seem to feel like there's a really it's important to know who their donors are. Now, $16 million, that's a lot of money, and I'm sure it's not all just people sending 20, 50, 100 bucks their way. There's going to be some big numbers in there. And I've worked for a small nonprofit. I mean, I think at the end of my time there, after 17 years, we were maybe getting close to $1 million a year, and that was after 17 years. And we always filed annual reports. And maybe we didn't always have the money to print them in a glossy, fancy brochure and hand them out, but you always had that documentation, and even if you didn't print it, you had it available on your website, and for your other funders, because people who want to fund you want to know that you're want to know what work you're doing and want to know who else is funding you, and that's all really important. So earlier today, somebody tried to, let me see, let's see, where did it was in the comment section. Randall is like was upset with me, I guess. And he said, so this is quite interesting, and I wanted to share some of this because I think it's going to say a lot about how this campaign candidacy is going to go with RFK Jr. And again, Children's Health Defense at present is separate from him because he and Mary Holland are on leave. But I think it's hard to disentangle Children's Health Defense from the candidacy openly, because most of the people who are supporting kind of think they're the same thing, right? And so this is someone named Randall Betancourt, who like 5 hours ago he responded to the post on this lovely poem, and the only thing he could think of saying was nothing about the poem, just about he's endorsing this candidacy. And so I'm just going to read Randall. I feel like I can do this because he's It's a public comment. He says, RFK Jr. is openly calling out the CIA for the deep state assassination of JFK. And for the first time, your average American will hear this. The other day, he called out openly for the closing down of 800 plus military bases of the U.S. empire, ringing the globe, staging grounds for U.S. special ops, essentially private armies with no oversight that we have roaming, as this is written in over 100 countries. He has already called out the setting up of Russia in Ukraine, a debacle, and the slaughter daily of thousands upon thousands of poor Ukrainians, all in our name. Now, if you listen to my critique of RFK Jr., like in what I've written, you know, more recently, he's actually like with Vantage Point, he was funding ocean drones. So I'm not totally buying like the anti-imperialist framing might be conveniency for his presidency, his presidential run. But, you know, I'm not quite buying his like deep in his heart. He's always been an anti-imperialist. Like he was investing in ocean drones now owned by Boeing, Liquid Robotics. So, you know, so much for that. Every day this broken and divided land comes a new ritual slaughter, euphemistically termed mass shootings. My point, blockchain issues, social impact investing, and the like are all extremely important issues of the highest order to tackle for the future of humanity. But let's not fool ourselves. These are long-term endgame topological puzzles thrown out by the darker forces that will go away, way over the heads of the pinhead academics at the most elite universities. It is going to take some time, as my father used to say. So don't worry your little head about this, Allison. We haven't paid any attention to you like for the past 3 years. But now somehow, like maybe we're gonna like eventually we'll get around to Web3 blockchain, right? Like once the Vantage Point Partners has it all sewed up. And all of this is to say, for God's sake, the cybernetic creature is now raping and pillaging us in our beautiful planet while we, like cloistered elites, expect folks to get the subtleties of hedge funds and impact investing. It's not subtle. It's slavery. It's digital slavery. And actually, most recently, RFK Jr. has been shouting from the rooftops about crypto, how it's wonderful. Probably not incidentally linked to their new board members, the Centners, based in Miami, which is the hotbed of blockchain and crypto. And actually, interestingly enough, Children's Health Defense has about $78,000 in cryptocurrencies in some sort of Coinbase wallet, according to their filings. That was in 2021. So yeah, I think some of the people over at Children's Health Defense do get what I'm saying. They're just playing the other side, okay? Meanwhile, the spiritual battle between heaven and earth must be fought on many levels across many timelines of prioritization if we are to survive. I am campaigning for RFK Jr. Well, like you couldn't tell me. So, this is the narrative tropes here, right? The Kennedy legacy, the deep state, the captured government, the people are waking up. Don't bother with the details. Don't think about the details. That'll come later. Just go behind the hero, okay? He's the hero and he's doing the stuff. You know, and please, you know, don't say anything. And so, you know, I responded and I said, let's see, where is this? Yeah, so this is my response. Hey, Randall, are you willing to contact Children's Health Defense and ask them to release a list of their major donors since 2019? And I've asked for these recently. I've asked, and it was a very reasonable request, $5,000 gifts and up. I'm not asking for every $20 gift, but if someone has given you $5,000 in a calendar year, like that's a substantial gift, right? So I said, don't you think the public deserves to understand who $16 million they're spending? $16 million. Do we not deserve to actually know who that is? So then Randall says, well, and they're always, this is so funny because I've had this back and forth with the head of Children's Health Defense in Pennsylvania. He's in Philly, I think. I mean, he's in Philly. I don't know if he's the head of Philadelphia Children's Health Defense or the entire state, but he it's the same modus operandi, like stroke my ego. We love your research. We think you're great. Please don't you need to be nice on us and not piss on our fire of the people that everybody loves, because then you'll be isolated on an island. Like that's what I got from somebody else. But we love the research. Keep it going. Eventually, maybe someday we'll get around to doing something about it, right? And so this is the same thing. Let me say, I think your work is extremely valuable and I thank you for your courage and fortitude. I am sure it is a labor of love. I am going to try not to make any further comments on RFK Jr. in the comment section. Keyword try. As far as donors, PACs, lists, and the like, Children's Health Defense is just a small fry fighting to stay alive and further its mission. As you well know, it is a non-starter of a question, as while their attorneys likely don't know what you are talking about when you get into larger cybernetic future scenarios, they do know that money in this age is this age In This Age is lifeblood, and they are being paid like the lawyers for other entities to protect their sources. Okay, like, so he's saying that they're being sneaky, right? Like, he's just saying that they're being sneaky. So I wouldn't want to call them on these matters just yet. I want to see if we can keep Bobby Kennedy alive long enough so he can blurt out some truth into the microphone to Joe Sixpack. So this narrative, and I don't even know if Randall Betancourt is a real person, it's so cookie cutter, like they're going to use it over and over and over again. So I'm just pointing this out because this is... If you're going to walk through this labyrinth, like, you have to understand what the narratives are that are being crafted. And so the narratives are, don't sweat the details. It's not your time. We're talking down to the dummies. We're going to tell them about the captured government, right? But we're not going to tell them about a possibly captured nonprofit that's churning through $16 million and not open about who its donors are, right? We're not going to talk about that. We're not going to say that the emperor has no clothes, that somehow $16 million is a small fry operation. And I just, it's just crazy. So yeah, so I replied, I said, Randall, $16 million is not a small fry. What are they hiding? This is not okay for any nonprofit, let alone an organization affiliated with a presidential candidate. So I forgot to sort of pull over the screen, but that's sort of my beginning. And, you know, I'm waiting because now it looks like we have some more people on the screen, which is great. I'm hoping that you guys are still there. Let me see. Is my stream still going?
This is not okay for any nonprofit.
All right. Well, I'm hoping that you guys are still there. I'm not sure. Somehow my thing disappeared on me. Oh, I guess it's still live. Okay. Sorry, if you'll just wait a second. Okay, there we are. All right, so you're still there, good. All right, so you know, I'm glad. It looks like we have some good people on the line, so I didn't wanna go ahead and read the lovely poem with not enough of an audience. So anyway, I think we've got a nice crowd here. I do wanna point out, if you're not sure, that this is one of these filings that I was looking at. The Children's Health Defense, they have to file in California, but actually the California 2021 filing included the 990 from the IRS. So this is Children's Health Defense now in Franklin Lakes, New Jersey. Heidi Kidd is the treasurer, and I will have to say, like, looking at all the salaries, you know, I actually called Heidi today because they provide her number here because she keeps the books. And I'm like, Heidi, you need a raise. Like, you're the most underpaid person. She's the treasurer in the whole organization. So I was like, Heidi, you know, really seriously, you guys need to get your act together with an annual report because you've got a spinoff of a publication company and a video company, and you've got this, like, you're spending $500,000 every year on publications, but you haven't got an annual report. And that's like, it doesn't look good. I'm just saying that as somebody who says, you know, we need to be paying attention. Because I sent it on Sunday, an email using their form, and they got back to me on Monday, so prompt response. But I had essentially put a formal request in to ask for their donors from, again, reasonable request, January 1st of 2019 to December 31st of 2022, of gifts $5,000 and up. Right. So they got back to me. So I sent it by their online form and I sent it by text. And so I got a response to the online form on Monday, and then I got a response to the text today. So I wanted just to put this out and document it. So I got a reply to the online form from someone named Tracy at Children's Health Defense. And they said, hi, Allison, we do not share information about donors. Regards, Tracy. Okay. And so then my reply was, dear Tracy, does Children's Health Defense not maintain annual reports? Most nonprofit organizations with annual budgets of $15 million, it kind of goes back to between 15, like, and like high $15 million and low $16 million, prioritize transparency with regards to their sources of income. I worked for a small nonprofit for many years, and we always made an annual report publicly available with a list of major donors. To most people, this would appear rather suspicious, especially given RFK Jr.'s candidacy. One of your chapter leaders recently told me that the organization has been able to grow so much due to the generous support from its many wealthy donors. Do you not imagine your supporters and the general public have a right to know who they are? I want to advise you that I do plan to discuss this. If Children's Health Defense's policy changes, I would welcome the information. I've already found out enough to do a series of discussions by analyzing your IRS 990s and California filings. And I plan to spend some time with the Foundation Directory online later this week. Unlike Children's Health Defense, many foundations make their philanthropic activities publicly available. And then I have the date of May 8th, 2023. And so this is the text I sent to the text on Sunday afternoon. I would like to make a formal request for a list of major donors, those individuals and entities making gifts or grants of $5,000 or more to Children's Health Defense between January 1st, 2019 and December 31st, 2022, and CHD's annual reports for those years. Please forward this information to my teamsila at protonmail.com address. This request was made on May 7th, 2023. Thank you. I look forward to having a better understanding of your donor base. And so this is the response I got this afternoon. Dear sir or madam, Children's Health Defense does not share the names of our donors, nor do we produce annual reports. Thank you for your inquiry. Okay. And then I said, okay, well, I'll be sure to let the public know that your organization, which had a $16 million budget in 2021, is not transparent about its funding sources. Shame on Children's Health Defense for not producing an annual report. And so I think that, you know, I'm just going to put an ask out. Like, I think everybody should be calling Children's Health Defense, contacting them through their form and demanding an annual report accounting, at least for the last 2 years where the budget's going from $6 and $7 million. This is where I've been putting together the spreadsheet. I've got, I'm gonna make it, I can probably, I'm almost done. I'll put the link in the comments because all of these are hot links to the various reports and I now have them saved online so you don't have to download them. They were coming through this link, the California Attorney General Registry, so you can find them there. And so, you know, I was going through, again, from 2008 all the way to 2021. And, you know, you can look at, like, the gross annual revenue. And this is starting in 2008. A lot of it was related to this guy, Ed Gladden, who was making a film called Trace Amounts. And, you know, for these first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, very typical startup nonprofit, right? Like, very typical. 28,000 budget, 5,000, 7, 12, 5, 23, 13. Like, that looks like a very grassroots handful of people nonprofit. Then this is the year of their film, and or the year after, I guess the year it was in distribution. The film only made like $80,000 total, but you can see the money starts pouring in. And RF Kennedy Jr. was involved in the film, and then it just goes up from there. So it's like in 2015, it's $467,000. And then, you know, it just jumps. The next year, 736. The next year, 1.1 million. The next year, 2.974 million. That's 2019. So that's that was, I think, fueled largely by the responses to the clampdown around the measles, quote unquote, outbreaks around the country and the removal of the religious exemptions for schools. And then it jumps to 6.8 million and 16 million, right? That's not small fry money. That's very big fry money, especially when you've got someone who's running a presidential candidacy. So and again, part of this is what I'm asking. And, you know, we look at salaries here, and I'm just going to say, so initially, the first year, the only person who got an official salary was Ed Gladden. And he, again, he was the original founder of what was at that time called the Mercury Project. 2017 was the first year RFK Jr. got a salary. And again, it was, I'm sure for somebody of his stature, relatively modest, $131,000. And then, but it went up amazingly high over the next 5 years. And I've worked in a nonprofit. Like, you're lucky if you get a cost of living raise, right? And I would say the big jumps in RFK Jr.'s salary were coming during the lockdowns at a time of, like, profound economic uncertainty for people, right? Lots of people being laid off, lots of people on food stamps, lots of people not knowing what their next opportunity is, right? And so I would say, to a certain extent, like, this is a time where, especially if you're someone who has, like, he relocated to Malibu and bought a multi-million dollar home, right? And so this is somebody who has a cushion, right? This is somebody who has quite a bit of a cushion. I mean, he may be the Camelot hero, but he definitely has a cushion. So the money that's pouring in, the salary goes from $131,000 and change in 2017, 28 the next year, it's over $50,000 salary increase, right? That's a huge jump. That doesn't happen in the nonprofit world. world, right? So, you know, $184,000. And then it jumps again by like $75,000. Like, who gets that kind of raise? Like, who's like, ah, oh, next year we'll just give you another $75,000, right? So then in 2019, it's $255,000. And then the next year, it's like a $90,000 raise, $345,000. And then in the most recent year of 2021, it's just shy of $500,000, $497,000 and $497,013, right? A couple. So it's kind of crass, honestly. Like, I just think it's kind of crass. And so, and they're going to tell us that we don't need to know who's paying his salary, right? Now he's on leave and on that sort of thing. But I'm just saying this needs closer attention. And what I'm going to say is they're going to try to sort of focus all of this as a Camelot hero story, but then we ourselves have to be responsible people who believe in the cause or line up behind to hold our leaders accountable. Like, isn't that the whole thing about the supposed like Kennedy, you know, legacy is that, oh, the deep state went after them because, you know, this, that, or the other, like, you know, we're going to hold captured agencies accountable. And yet to me, it feels like there seems like a pretty, you know, unless they turn the tide pretty quickly on terms of how they're dealing with being public and transparent about their funding as a nonprofit, then they're just as captured as the agencies that they're ostensibly trying to like hound about these other issues. It's not good. Okay, so that's my broad context for this Camelot post. So I'm not saying it nearly as eloquently as this person. It was, they go by the pen name Meandering Mermidid, and it was left as a comment on the PEC post yesterday. And I did get in touch with them and said, is it okay to make it its own post because it's just so good? And they graciously said yes, that I could do that. So I'm going to read aloud a poem that is shared on the blog by Meandering Mermidin called The Once and Future Thing. And it's sort of channeling a bit of the Camelot. And I do want to say, oh, this is one thing I want to make sure I say before. I think that, you know, as reading through it and that it was sent my way, the implication I think is maybe that Alice is like a reflection of the work that I'm doing or that we're doing together, you know, the group of us that are doing this kind of work. I do want to emphasize that I think for the narrative purposes, it was framed out that like a knight came and made an offer and I refused. In real life, that never happened. There's never been any knights or anyone else on behalf of any institutions coming up to me and like making, you know, offering deals or anything that I, you know, turned down. And I'm glad because I think that would be really inappropriate behavior for someone to make such an offer. And of course, I wouldn't ever accept that kind of offer. So as I'm reading through, if you're reading between the lines and sort of imagining that this is a reflection of the work that myself and those sort of in my, you know, immediate circle and people doing these wonderful guest posts, and I've had a lot of guest posts lately, that didn't really happen in real life. It's good for the narrative flow of the poem, and you know, honestly, it uplifts me in a way that I don't quite deserve because I haven't, you know, had that happen to me. And I don't want to make this just about me and a personality thing because I realize how toxic that gets, but I'm not putting this out there just to like, be like, oh, look at me, I'm so great that people write me poems. But it's just such a clever poem. And I laughed out loud, like when I read it to my husband yesterday morning. And, you know, again, he continues to be skeptical of the work that I do. And I put it out and he laughed and he thought it was pretty marvelous. So anyway, I just wanted to make sure it gets a wider listening. Okay, so The Once and Future Thing. Just before cock crow in a darkling hotel lobby, the spectral father cries, quote, the hour's come, avenge me, Bobby. And yeah, that goes exactly with that Betancourt quote. And from his crystal palace, the dynastic chosen son doles oxytocin tokens to the wronged and innocent ones. And that's from that Glimpser neuroeconomic video about the oxytocin. Nobly wounded, audibly shaken from scores of giants that he's felled, he whispers to the multitude what his father's ghost did tell. Quote, the salmon will be hooked, the well of wisdom will be plumbed, naught will remain unknown if we blockchain everyone. Now let us praise famous men. May their interest forever accrue. We'll accept all colors and proclivities. We can tokenize them too. In our liberated markets, every one will have a share. On this side, we'll make solutions and we'll make problems over there. With tokenized revolutions, we'll spin them round and round, and the energy they generate will power the cities and the towns. Join us, the impotence, all free agents and entrepreneurs, just donate your extra electrons. Oh, Mega Machine, we're yours. Come now, let's reforge the pact that was broken and pay for this succession with this non-fungible token. Meanwhile, in his tower, high above the broad Potomac, Merlin gazes in his palantir, muttering spells alchemical, gnomic. Director of the spectacle, playwright extraordinaire, Merlin moves his players about, charging waves hidden in air. But little Alice, scrappy mom from the city of the broken bell, raised her voice among the throng, warning, all was not so well. They say I'm nuts, said Alice. They say I'm not quite sane for thinking people are not pawns and that life is not a game. I've been into the labyrinth and gathered many threads. I've woven them together, and this is what they said. Then she unrolled a tapestry showing the lords of every land hunting for a quarry that they could not understand. And in the center was a unicorn, the quested after game. In magenta script, thereon was stitched, behold, the global brain. Merlin, in his tower, quickly consulted his chart of every outcome and income to find little Alice's part. He directed a trusted knight of the Children's Health Crusade to entice little Alice with the sums she could be paid. Alas! To no avail, the crusader wooed in vain. Stubborn and immovable, Alice's tale remained the same. Merlin, in his wrath, demands, who let this thistle grow? This pissabed that sprouted from my neatly tended row. So the master of illusion broadcasts more at which to stare. He invokes his spell most tried and true. Hey, you, look over there. Spectacular scenes emerge like toadstools after rain. Hairy men in queenly drag, war, disease, exploding trains, all the tricks long utilized to hypnotize the peasants. And I don't know what happened next. This hasn't passed, it's present. I pulled the sword and the stone. We've got the Merlin and the Camelot crowd. You know, and I don't mean this to be mean, but honestly, like, this matters. This $16 million here that we don't know where it came from, it matters. It matters. And you know, in going through the IRS forms, I found quite a number of interesting points for further exploration that I'll do probably later this week. I'll spend a little bit more time on that. But even at this baseline, this $16 million... any normal nonprofit would have an annual report with its major donors, especially in line of having a presidential candidacy coming, right? And the fact that, you know, Children's Health Defense does not share the names, and they make it sound like that's inappropriate. No, most organizations have a donor list at these large amounts. They do. And they don't produce annual reports, and that's a problem. So this came out, so I posted this morning, and then someone else, again, I've been spending my last 3 days making, you know, these really intense, you know, this is a lot to go through. I have, you know, all of the numbers, unusual things I put in a Kumu map, you know, grants and all of this, just to see the trajectory, because it's really important to see how it all pulls together. Yeah, so that was taking up my time the last 3 days, but somebody else, you know, alerted me, actually two different people. They were like, uh-oh, have you seen what's going on over at Celia Farber's place? And I was like, oh, like, I can't, I, you know, shame on me. Like, you know, fool me once, hurt me once, shame on you. Do it twice, shame on me, right? And that's exactly where So I'm not going back twice. I'm not really looking. And yet someone was generous enough because in this most recent blog post, she's essentially threatening litigation of libel for people saying that she's a psyop or something like that. And again, what happened is the person who took these various screenshots and shared them over with me is that she did her old bag of tricks, which was pull a comment from a previous blog post and throw it up and create a bunch of foment around it and like drama, and then let her ant computer run around a bunch. And you know, it would be sort of hilarious if she wasn't sort of, you know, threatening people with legal action, but somehow clearly my name got thrown in the mix. And, you know, I want to sort of point out the trajectory here. As it turns out, the person who made the initial comment that got lifted out, they weren't even accurate with it. They were like, oh, well, I didn't actually say, the person never said that. I was just kind of generalizing and using my own words. So like, I'm sorry I created this whole scene. But essentially all the stuff that she's writing about in this latest blog post didn't really happen the way she presumed that it happened to create this like extreme reaction. So, you know, I'm just putting this here because it's, again, at the end, there was one, I don't know, maybe more than one because somebody sent me an expanded comment. But Ian Bell was the one person saying, like, do you actually have any evidence this is actually a real thing? Like, before we go on and have hundreds of comments. Because someone here, this person, JP, pulled me in and said, oh, well, I can't say for sure who's pushing it, but it's very clear who hates your existence. And then this person put two links, one of whom I don't know, another Substack longtime dissident. I don't know who that is because this is all about like AIDS dissident stuff, which isn't really my bag at all. I know about it, but I don't know any of these players. And then me, right? And so, you know, before I came over, I was like, well, huh. You know, I wonder who this JP person is, right? That he's going to throw my name in the chumming waters, the bloody waters, right? And in the watch the frenzy, because this thing never even happened. Like literally this person, Cosmos Ancient Ranger, is saying, oh, I had an exchange with a gentleman who said something about John and Celia or something, something. And then she just created a whole post and just made a nonsense thing out of it. But it turns out that this guy, JP, when I looked up his Substack, well, look at the most recent post. This is kind of fascinating. So it seems that JP is all about net zero climate stuff, and he's literally pitching next gen nuclear, which is the focus of what I've been talking about with the Matthew Arrett and Fox Green thing, right? Like, so I've been really questioning next gen nuclear, especially in the context of Web3. So isn't it interesting that this person, JP, of this, you know, whatever this other his Substack, you know, same guy, is actually the one doing, running around pitching green energy on green nuclear energy. So yeah, so maybe he has a bit of an axe to grind. I was thinking maybe it was just for me calling out Children's Health Defense. I'm a convenient target, but maybe JP is a little pissy about me pointing out that next gen nuclear might not be all that. But here is Ian Bell saying, excuse me, but you know, is there evidence supporting this claim? Like before we start like taking funding for a law litigation. And you know, the sad thing is, I don't hate her. Like she's projecting this. I spent four posts sort of responding to her initial weirdness about my video about repurposed drugs and pay for sex finance. But really when Cliff and I sort of unpacked what had happened in this ant computer charade game, you know, I have a certain degree of empathy for, because it takes two to tango, right? It takes an instigator and then it takes the swarm. And so the swarm is equally responsible in what unfolds as the instigator, right? They need one another. And it's a codependency. And I think it's very unhealthy for both parts of the both parties. It escalates, right? And then eventually this Cosmos Agent Ranger is saying something like, oh, well, I apologize. You know, and this is after the horse is out of the barn. You know, he didn't use the expression PSYOP, and that expression, the Duesberg-led sidewalk, that's my words. And, you know, so yeah, it's my summary. Like, I didn't mean to misrepresent anything or mislead anybody. And like, there was an accusation, and like essentially none of this really happened, Celia. So, you know, I think this is important because, again, Celia is definitely within the Camelot circle, right? And at the same time, it's interesting how things go together. Another friend, the one who has been writing about slime mold, sent me this really interesting, fascinating article, which I feel like is a missing piece, about insulin and eusociality in ant colonies, right? And I've been doing some work in that I haven't presented yet about the Spokane, Washington. It's going to be another installment in the Flow Life series about Mark Andreessen and Adam Newman's Flow Life, touching on this Ways to Wellville program with Esther Dyson, who is a former founding chair, I think, of ICANN and the daughter of Freeman Dyson, the physicist and space colonization guy. And for 10 years, she's been setting up like wellness programs in like small towns. And she's also like, there's her dad, Freeman Dyson, this visionary. And she's a Russophile. So she's on the board of Yandex, which I guess is like the equivalent of Google in Russia. And she's trained as a cosmonaut for this private space flight. And so she has like all of these ties to Russia, which of course is also linked into with the parapsychology. There she's on Yandex's board. And in one of these articles, she's a bit of a quantified self freak. And I think it's not just her, personal interest, it's about selling health tech and monitoring devices. And so in addition to like a whole bunch of sleep monitoring devices, she uses a glucose monitor, even though she's a skinny, skinny woman and she doesn't have diabetes, and she thinks everyone should wear a glucose monitor. And that didn't really make a lot of sense to me, right? It didn't make a lot of sense, only until my friend, the slime mold friend, sends me the insulin article, Insulin Making Ant Societies. So I'm going to read this article out loud because I think it's going to be really important to think about like managing people through glucose. And, you know, I did have a bit of an email exchange with Emily Moyer a while ago because she has done a lot of work around sugar as programmable matter. And I was looking at this OA program and the way the sugar also connects to the Quakers the plantation culture in the Caribbean and like Hershey and Cadbury and sociocracy. There's something really weird going on with sugar, and she has her own angle about it that's more from a like the MK Ultra mind control kind of side of things. The stuff I'm looking at is more about finance and history and the fact that Hershey was the anchor tenant at the Pennovation Grasp Lab, which is where they train their swarm robots. And Hershey has a really crazy backstory because it's connected to this huge trust for the Hershey company that's supposedly like funding a school for special needs kids. And it's super sketch, and it's like billions and billions of unaccounted for dollars, right? Like in that kind of game, Children's Health Defense is like, it is like a small, you know, compared to the Hershey Fund. But like, what exactly is Hershey doing as the first anchor tenant in the University of Pennsylvania's swarm engineering incubator complex, right? So I thought I would just read aloud this article so that we can think about, again, Esther Dyson steering people and this idea of a glucose monitor and insulin. Because again, the diabetes social impact bonds are the first social impact bonds, and they're also connected to wearable clothing like smart shirts and pedometers and Fitbits and all of that sort of thing. So I haven't actually read this myself. I don't think it's super long, but I am going to just read it aloud here. Okay. So how insulin helped create ant societies. This is in Quantum magazine, and this is from 2018, Jordana Kapelowitz, a senior writer for Quantum magazine. How insulin helped create ant societies. Evolution may have co-opted an ant metabolic mechanism to set social insects on the path towards one of the most puzzling behaviors found in nature. Okay. Ant larvae quietly manipulate the insulin levels of adults to induce caretaking behavior, as shown above. This kind of signaling may be what enabled colonies of ants and other social insects to evolve castes of non-reproductive workers. And that's a key part of that. Ants, wasps, bees, and other social insects live in highly organized, quote-unquote, eusocial colonies, where throngs of females forego reproduction, usually viewed as the cornerstone of evolutionary fitness, to serve the needs of a few egg-laying queens and their offspring. How they got that way has been hard to explain, despite more than 150 years of biologists' efforts. Many researchers have thought the answer would come down to a complex suite of genetic changes that evolved in species-specific ways over a long time. But new results suggest that a surprisingly simple hormonal mechanism, one that can be found throughout the animal kingdom, may have been enough to set eusociality in motion. Last month, a team of researchers led by Daniel Kronauer, an evolutionary biologist at Rockefeller University in New York, published a paper in Science that many experts are saying provides one of the most detailed molecular stories to date in the study of eusocial behavior. The scientists found that division of reproductive labor in ants arose when an ancient insulin signaling pathway, typically involved in maintaining nutrition and growth, became responsive to social cues. In doing so, they also uncovered deeper insights into a process underlying how the environment gets under the skin to affect behavior, physiology, and the health and well-being of other members of a society, said Jean E. Robinson, an entomologist and the director of the Carl W. Woese Institute for Genomic Biology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Kronauer and his colleagues, hoping to uncover a common origin for the ants' evolutionary journey towards eusociality, first compared which genes were expressed differently in the brains of the queens and workers among seven diverse ant species. They found a particularly strong signal for one gene, ILP2, which codes for the ant version of insulin and was expressed consistently higher in queens. At least two dozen other genes emerged as important as well. Kronauer noted many of them also related to insulin production and signaling, or to brain plasticity and other traits. To determine the role of ILP2, the researchers focused on a single ant species, the clonal raider ants, Oseriae beroi, whose colony lack fixed queens. Instead, the ants alternate as a group between worker and queen roles, seemingly in response to the presence of larvae. With babies around, all adult ants stopped reproducing to take care of them. Kronauer's team found that insulin signaling was responsible for that cycle. Production of the hormone declined when the researchers exposed the ants to larvae, suppressing reproduction and inducing the shift to caretaking behavior. When the larvae were removed, insulin levels rose significantly, and injecting the adults with insulin caused their ovaries to reactivate even when the larvae were still around. If you think about it, it's a crazy but also very elegant and simple way to make an organism social, to make it responsive to larvae, Kronauer said. And as Alan J. Moore, an entomologist at the University of Georgia, joked, anyone who's a parent knows that your kid manipulates you. And then it has an image of a lot of larvae and a couple of adult ants tending to them. And it says, the caption, in colonies of clonal raider ants, the adult females do not fall into fixed castes. Instead, they alternate in unison between laying eggs and caring for their young. And again, I keep saying all of the socialism, all of the you know, everyone who wants to call it communitarianism or socialism or communism, it's ants. It's social insects. That this single gene has such a major effect suggests that the transition from a solitary to a social lifestyle can begin with relatively few changes, said Andrew Suarez, a biologist at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. You don't need to invoke novel genes. You don't need to massively change the genomic architecture or gene expression patterns. You can just tweak one or a few things and start on this path towards advanced reproductive division of labor. Kronauer's results vindicate a theory about the origins of eusociality proposed in 1987 by the evolutionary biologist May Jane West Eberhard, now at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. She had observed that solitary wasp cycles through reproductive and caretaking phases in sync with their ovarian activity and posited that the eusocial division of labor emerged when parts of that ovarian cycle became exclusive to each caste. The queens had constantly active ovaries for egg laying, while the workers, whose ovaries stayed suppressed, dedicated themselves to foraging and brood care. West Eberhard later described this as a model for making major changes in species through developmental reorganization, and called it a way of making something new, worker and queen phenotypes, out of old pieces. In this case, the old behaviors linked to different phases of solitary wasp's ovarian cycle. What was missing from West Eberhard's theory was a candidate for a potential trigger for that reorganization in the wasps or in any of the other social insects. Cronauer's findings now suggest that the culprit, at least in the case of ants, was ILP2, with the larvae manipulating the adults through their insulin pathways to turn most into full-time caretakers and a few into mothers to the community. Insulin's involvement makes sense in retrospect, Cronauer said, given that the hormone is known to play a crucial regulatory role in both food intake and reproduction. After the initial adaptation, evolutionary forces would have driven innate differences in insulin levels among individuals further apart to cement separate castes. Even among the queenless clonal raider ants, Cronauer and his colleagues observed that some had slightly larger, more active ovaries and foraged less, despite the presence of larvae. Their insulin levels turned out to be higher from the start. Even in this precursory state, there still seems to be a connection between reproductive behavior and insulin levels, Cronauer said. Ultimately, individuals with higher insulin levels became queens, and those with lower level became workers. It starts out in a population where everyone is very similar, but over evolutionary time, those small differences get exacerbated. What makes this work additionally compelling is that previous research implicated insulin in the governing division of labor in honeybees as well, but in a very different way. For those bee species which evolved eusociality independently from ants, insulin signaling helped determine whether workers forage or stay behind to nurse larvae, and can govern the kind of food the foragers prefer, which further affects their physiology and the tasks they perform. In both ants and the honeybees, the insulin mechanism is entwined with sensitivity to offspring. And and then it says, in this video, the researchers at Ingrid Fetter Pruneda and Vikram Chandra of the Rockefeller University explain how the regulation of insulin levels in adult ants by their larvae may have laid the foundation for a social structure with egg-laying queens and non-reproductive workers. It suggests that there is something very general about how evolution proceeds when it increases the complexity of a system, Cronauer said. To Suarez, it means that this kind of evolutionary innovation is in some sense predictable, that there are genetic mechanistic patterns at play, and that's pretty exciting. That insulin has been used multiple times independently also reinforces an emerging insight that evolution routinely reuses conserved metabolic and developmental pathways to give rise to complex new traits and behaviors. In the case of social insects, the insulin and reproductive pathways were only waiting to be co-opted for social functions or derived from ancestral ground plans, said Karen Kappheim, an evolutionary biologist at Utah State University. Evolution is a tapestry of something old, something new, Robinson said. We see this beautifully on display in this work. The ancient, highly conserved insulin pathway with this new piece interposed, one that particular life stage, the babies, can influence the insulin signaling status and therefore the physiological state of the adults. Cronauer and others still need to determine how the larvae elicited that signaling response in the adults, and how insulin became so responsive to social cues in the first place. More work is also needed on what's happening in the ants' brains to mediate this process. The fact that insulin signaling is so important in other animals has wider implications as well. For instance, insect queens are significantly larger than workers and enjoy considerably longer lifespans. According to Cronauer, the underlying reasons for these differences remain unknown, but his study implies that insulin signaling could be at play. People can now start to look at whether insulin signaling in other organisms, including humans, plays a similar role in modulating something life expectancy, he said. And perhaps it plays a role in the evolution of primitive social behaviors in other species as well, added Moore, who studies transitions to social organization in beetles. In his field, we don't have such a complete causative story, he said. It really raises the bar for the rest of us. So that's pretty interesting, right? I mean, guys, can you see how this fits together? Because to me, again, the destruction of the family, right? The idea of communal living, the destruction of the family, while it has woven into it this these political or economic infrastructures going back, you know, the last century or so, if you understand it that the goal is to turn us into ants for some ant computer problem, that's really interesting. And then overlay that with the fact that the social impact, let me see if I can come up with the social impact bond. Yeah. Let's see. Yeah. Cities changing diabetes. Denmark's first health social impact bond is ready for launch. The Danish city of Aarhus joined Cities Changing Diabetes with an ambitious type 2 diabetes prevention plan. So this idea of getting everybody on a diabetes prevention plan, like, could be about regulating the signals around insulin. And let me see. Like, and these glucose monitoring, I mean, there's all these different kinds of glucose monitoring. And they were saying, like, oh yeah, even skinny people, people have no issues, should all wear a glucose monitor. And that doesn't make sense, right? Unless, I mean, on the one hand, you could say, oh, look, it's these pharmaceutical companies. They're all, you know, selling us stuff that we don't need to make money. But what if it's actually about a signaling for social behavior, for youth social behavior? That's pretty intense. So I think that pretty much just covers, you know, what I wanted to talk to you today. Again, the thing with Celia Farber's Substack, again, not really Celia, but more the people who are hopping on, like who are acting, like responding to her trigger and her signal, you know, just a real mess. I was saying people should just go out and blow some dandelions and like take de-stress, right? Because there's a lot more interesting things that we need to be paying attention to. Let me see. Than, you know, being like, oh my gosh, look, somebody said something, whatever. I mean, and they didn't even say it. Like, it's all made up, like the whole thing. Like, I don't know, like somebody spent, you know, a whole bunch of their time yesterday, like saying mean things about me. And I don't even, like, that woman isn't even on my radar, any of the things she talks about. This is the Diabetes Health Impact Bond in Sweden, and it's connected to this EIT health movement project. And, you know, and you can see the other entities that are involved in this, Sweden, let's see. Oh, this is an interesting one. Social Finance Israel, Social Finance UK, Rotterdam, and then we've got Karolinska Institute, and the IESE Business School is quite interesting because, you know, Barcelona is the center of all this smart city everything, and this business school, essentially, it's an extension of Opus Dei. Like, it's run by Opus Dei, the Vatican. It's in Barcelona, so that's. Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So, you know, I guess I will just say in the closing, you know, here we've got Children's Health Defense. We do not share the names of our donors, nor do we produce annual reports. And yet we do take in $16 million in a year, and we don't really feel any inclination to say anything about it. So just trust us, because we're Camelot. And, you know, I think in that level of trust, it is kind of like the Hive, right? You know, I don't know, is RFK Jr., you know, supposed to be the queen bee there, you know, and all the people, you know, you've got the king, you know, you've got the kingdom, and then you've got the knights, and then you've got the peons, and like the peon people are just not really supposed to, you know, ask questions, right? But we're still allowed to ask questions, at least ostensibly. This is all supposed to be what? Like, about restoring the American dream. So we don't need any Merlins, and we don't need any heroes. We just need to be more clear thinking ourselves. And so again, thank you, Meandering Myrmidon, for your wonderful rendering of the once and future thing. You know what? I'm just going to read it once again to close, because I think some people came late and it's just so good. So I'm going to close with one more reading. Yes, from a guest poem from Meandering Myrmidon, just with the caveat that no offer was ever made to me, and I didn't ever accept any offer. So that part of this story is the one piece that is just there for the narrative, but didn't actually happen in real life. Okay, the once and future thing. Just before the cock crow in a darkling hotel lobby, the spectral father cries, "The hours come, avenge me, Bobby." And from his crystal palace, the dynastic chosen son doles oxytocin tokens to the wronged and innocent ones. Nobly wounded, audibly shaken from the scores of giants that he's felled, he whispers to the multitude what his father's ghost did tell. The salmon will be hooked, the well of wisdom will be plumbed, naught will remain unknown if we blockchain everyone. Let us now praise famous men, may their interest forever accrue, we'll accept all colors and proclivities, we can tokenize them too. In our liberated markets, everyone will have a share, on this side we'll make solutions and we'll make problems over there. With tokenized revolutions, we'll spin them round and round, and the energy they generate will power the cities and towns. Join us, the impotents, all free agents and entrepreneurs. Just donate your extra electrons. Oh, mega machine, we're yours. Come now, let's reforge the pact that was broken and pay for the succession with this non-fungible token. Meanwhile, in his tower, high above the broad Potomac, Merlin gazes in his palantir, muttering smells alchemical and gnomic. Director of the spectacle, playwright extraordinaire, Merlin moves his players about, charging waves hidden in air. But little Alice, scrappy mom from the city of the broken bell, raised her voice among the throng, warning all was not so well. They say I'm nuts, said Alice. They say I'm not quite sane for thinking people are not pawns and that life is not a game. I've been into the labyrinth and gathered many threads. I've woven them together, and this is what they said. She then unrolled a tapestry showing the lords of every land hunting for a quarry that they could not understand. In the center was a unicorn, the quested after game. In magenta script, thereon was stitched, behold, the global brain. Merlin, in his tower, quickly consulted his chart of every outcome and income to find little Alice's part. He directed a trusted knight of the Children's Health Crusade to entice little Alice with the sum she could be paid. Alas, to no avail. The crusader wooed in vain. Stubborn and immovable, Alice's tale remained the same. Merlin, in his wrath, demands, who let this thistle grow, this pissabed that sprouted from my neatly tended row? So the master of illusion broadcasts more at which to stare. He invokes his spell, most tried and true. Hey you, look over there. The spectacular scenes emerge like toadstools after rain. Hairy men in queenly drag, war disease, exploding trains. All the tricks long utilized to hypnotize the peasants. And I don't know what happened next. This hasn't passed, it's present. And so that's Meandering Myrmidian. And so thanks. And thanks to all the people. I've had quite a few people lately who've been submitting things to the blog, guest posts, and I haven't caught up with all of them. I still have a few in the hopper, so that's going to come online soon. I've been working, you know, again, so hard at the getting all of the numbers lined up for the Children's Health Defense stuff so I can really understand what's going on there as best I can without any of the donor information. And so thank you. Thank you for being like, you know, again, I'm not trying to create a hive. I'm not trying to create a swarm thing. I was telling someone today, you know, and not like I ever thought I would be a teacher, and I don't really know that I am a teacher, but, you know, if you were to use that construct, I think the Substack culture is more like the lecturer in an intro psych class in a state university system in a giant auditorium of all these people, right? And that's never going to be me. I'm much more like, let's sit down at a seminar with people who are actually really interested in the certain particular content, and let's all work on it together. And that's really been happening. That's people have really been stepping up and sharing and their perspectives in write-ups and emails and other things. And so, you know, a while ago when Mohita, my friend in Goa recommended, she does Vedic astrology, and she's like, Allison, just keep doing the work. Just keep doing the work, and then eventually the people will come up, right? And you know, again, I've had a lot of people show up and leave, and that's okay. So we just keep doing the work together. And there's another funny post I put up this morning from someone in on the other side of the pond who framed it all around eggs. And so, you know, I'm not going to read that one here, but you should go to my blog and look at it. I call it like, how do you like your eggs? And so, yeah, a big worldview framed around egg eaters and egg decorators and rotten egg throwers. And yeah, so rotten egg throwers, right? What are we going to do? So anyway, thanks for joining in on this sort of short stream tonight. I think my bread dough is risen enough now, so I'm going to go make my cabbage ground beef burak sandwiches for dinner. So take care, everybody. Thanks for coming by.